Good morning, Ms. Chisholm.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Barbara Chisholm for petitioners. This case involves statutory restrictions Congress very deliberately imposed on Mexico-domiciled trucks and drivers and their ability to engage in long-haul trucking throughout the United States, beyond the current commercial zones at the U.S.-Mexico border. Most recently, as you all are aware, in 2007, Congress passed a law that prohibits the department from granting such authority unless it first tests the safety of doing so through a pilot program that complies with the statutory requirements for such a program. Petitioners challenged the pilot program on a number of safety and environmental grounds. I'd like to focus on a few of those first that might benefit from oral argument, and I will also respond to the agency's arguments regarding petitioners' standing.
Want to do that first?
Yes, sure, Your Honor. Petitioner's standing here, in particular IBT's standing, is clearly controlled by this court's decision in IBT versus Pena. In Pena, this court, with little difficulty, held that IBT's members would face economic harm as well as increased risk to their safety as a result of a rule that eased restrictions on Mexican commercial truck drivers. Like the rule at issue in Pena, here the pilot program eases restrictions on Mexican trucks and drivers and allows more Mexico-domiciled trucks to compete with U.S. trucks. It is common sense that when an agency illegally exempts from regulation one group of entities, the competitors of those entities who are not exempted have standing to challenge the legal exemption.
So now you're aware of the government's challenges to your reliance on Pena.
I am, Your Honor. The government, I don't believe, seriously challenges our reliance on Pena in the economic harm. Most of their challenge comes to our standing based on increased risk of safety.
Well, what do you say in response to their argument that you have not submitted any declaration indicating that any individual member does the type of business that would be adversely affected by allowing long-haul drivers to come in from Mexico?
Well, Your Honor, we do submit declarations from individual IBT members.
They just say they are drivers.
No, the declarations go further, and they say that they, in particular, for example, Mr. Dean Allen's declaration says that he drives the routes that connect the border zone to other areas in the United States. And if
but
you
just keep, because we're driving along the same road doesn't necessarily mean we're competitors.
Well, it does, Your Honor. The practicalities of this program right now are such that right now, the Mexican trucks that come into the border zones drop off their loads in the border zones. And then it's U.S. drivers that will take those loads elsewhere throughout the United States.
What I'm getting at is all of this is second nature to you. It's not second nature to us.
Right.
All right. And so the question is, your members are not the only people on the road. Are your members doing that? Are they going to the border zones and picking up goods that were delivered from Mexico and taking them long haul in the United States? And nobody says that. Is that correct?
Your Honor, that's correct. We do not have a declaration where we state that a particular member is currently doing that work. But they are operating in the market because they are driving the same routes that are competing with the routes that will be driven now by Mexican
only
drivers.
If we're dealing in the same goods. I just need to understand this, that's all. Just because you and I drive from here to Connecticut doesn't mean we're competing.
Correct, Your Honor. The IBT members that we have identified drive goods from the areas in Mexico and around the border areas and drive throughout the United States, but particularly in the Southwest. So our declarations talk about the routes that these people drive. This court, in several of its competitive standing cases, has said that the new entrance of competitors into a market is in and of itself sufficient to establish competitor standing.
So the point is that anybody would know that a long-haul trucker on I-5 or I-15 is picking up goods from the border zones.
Not necessarily, Your Honor, but they are engaged in that market, and we believe that under this circuit's...
But this market is what I'm talking about, isn't it?
Right. Well, the market is the transport of goods throughout the United States by truck. And the IBT members engage in these long haul, in these long haul shipping. We don't have evidence in the record, I will admit, that has a particular driver who engages in that. But they are active in the same market. And this court has said that that competitive injury, when you ease restrictions, regulatory restrictions, on one group of entities and say it's easier for them to engage in this, is an economic harm to others who are active in that market.
This is sort of the El Paso situation, one of the cases cited there.
Right, and the El Paso...
So it's self-evident?
I do believe it is self-evident, and what we've done is put additional information into the record to say that IBT members are active in that market area. This case, yes, in El Paso, the court noted that recognized that allowing new entities to enter a market, quote-unquote, plainly threatens, end-quote, economic injury to those entities already in the market. And again, just to be clear, without the authorization granted by the pilot program here, Mexican trucks would otherwise be dropping off their goods in the border zone, and then a U.S. trucker driver would be doing that work.
Now, you respond to the amicus brief filed by the agriculture interests, but not to the brief filed by Mexico that says there are all these Mexican drivers here already.
Well, I read their amicus brief primarily as asking this court to take account of factors that are sort of are outside the legal arguments before the court. There are Mexican drivers.
Well, the government's brief refers to three classes of Mexican truck drivers that are already here in the United States.
Well, they are Mexico-domiciled trucks and drivers active in the border zone right now, and then there are also a few Mexican trucks that are active or have authority. I don't know if they're active or not, but have authority to operate throughout the United States, who were granted that authority before the moratorium was put in place. I want to turn briefly, since we're on standing, to IBT and Sierra Club's standing under NEPA. I think here it's clear that both Sierra Club and IBT have standing to bring their claims under NEPA. It's a purely procedural statute, as this court is aware. And IBT in particular has submitted declarations from members that establish that they drive in and around the areas the pilot program participants are expected to travel. Some of them live in these areas. They also have specific interests in limiting the diesel exhaust. One in particular has asthma that's affected by the diesel exhaust. And there's emissions in the record that the Mexican domiciled trucks will be more polluting, or on the whole are generally more polluting than U.S. trucks. This is clearly sufficient to establish our standing under NEPA. Turning to the merits, the pilot program here unlawfully excuses participants from mandatory safety certification requirements. It is undisputed that the agency, in designing this pilot program, decided that it was not going to require Mexico-domiciled vehicles to comply with the Motor Vehicle Safety Act certification requirements. These are statutory requirements, and the agency has no authority to waive these statutory requirements.
Well, they construe import, for example, narrowly. Why is that not a reasonable interpretation of the term import? And then so too on the introduction into commerce. Those are the two issues that at the outset for me are most challenging.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the introduction into interstate commerce is in fact a very clear-cut question. I think it's controlled by this court's decision in Brinegar. The agency's argument on interstate commerce is essentially that because Mexico-domiciled trucks who make long-haul trips throughout the United States begin their trip in Mexico, they're not in interstate commerce. And that's clearly wrong under Brinegar. Brinegar involved a case where buses who performed only intrastate routes argued that they were not in interstate commerce, and therefore the tires on those buses should not be regulated.
What does introduce mean here, by the way? introduce an introduction in this statutory?
Well, the definition in Brinegar was almost exactly the same. It was to deliver for introduction into interstate commerce. And the court in Brinegar said that means to enter into interstate traffic. And so long as you were entering onto the nation's highways and you were intermingling with what was undoubtedly interstate commerce, that was interstate commerce. You were introduced into interstate commerce. So I think that reading of identical language in Brinegar controls this court's resolution of what introduction for interstate commerce
so
means
just
here.
Driving is enough.
Yes. Driving on interstate, highways. And there can be no dispute that the Mexico domicile trucks that are participating in this pilot program are driving on interstate highways. So I don't think this court needs to reach what is, I think, a harder question of what import means here when
suppose
Brinegar,
I disagree with you on commerce. What about import here? If that were your only hook, how do you distinguish this from just someone coming into the country? Where's the line for import that you think the agency can't reasonably cross?
Well, I think what you do is you look at what is the meaning of the word import, and the dictionary definitions are different. There are some which the agency relies on that talk about import of goods and wares. There's also a definition that is to enter, and so the broader definition to enter would clearly cover the situation that where the Mexico domicile trucks are coming into the country. And I think once you have an ambiguity like that, you then look to the to the intent of Congress in passing this statute, which was clearly safety. So it would make no sense to not regulate the safety of these motor vehicles who are coming into the country. That construing import in a way to cover motor vehicles that are operating on the nation's roads to ensure that they're safe would be the definition that's most.
So is anyone just crossing the border driving a car into the country importing the car?
Yes, Your Honor. That's the interpretation that we would advance, but I don't think this court.
Even if there's no commercial transaction associated with it.
That's correct. But I don't think this court has to reach that question because interstate commerce is so clearly defined by this court's decision in Brinegar. Mm-hmm. And finally, on the certification requirements, I would just note that the agency here is not, to be very clear, the agency here is not arguing that what it's doing complies with the statute. Their argument is they simply don't have to comply with the statute. And for the reasons set forth in our briefs and because Brinegar here controls, we believe that's not.
I think they are arguing that they're complying with the statute.
No, Your Honor. In fact, what they argue is that there is no reason for, they do not have to comply with the statute and the statute does not apply to them. They then argue, by the way, we think that the regulations will ensure safety, but they do not make the argument that they are complying with. They argue that the statute doesn't apply to them.
They argue that the import provision that you just discussed doesn't cover this situation.
And they also argue that the interstate commerce does not
right.
apply to them. So their argument is that this does not apply, not that they are covered and complying. Turning to the question of the pilot program's acceptance of less stringent vision standards, the 2007 Act and the pilot program statute require the agency to design a program that will achieve levels of safety that are at least equivalent to full compliance with otherwise applicable safety regulations. Here, the agency has designed a pilot program that permits Mexican drivers to make long-haul trips throughout the United States without complying with U.S. vision requirements. Specifically, Mexican drivers are only required to have red vision, while U.S. commercial drivers must be able to recognize red, yellow, and green. In designing the pilot program, the agency was required to assess how that would affect safety. But the agency provided no reasoned explanation for why it believed that accepting this less stringent standard would achieve a level of safety at least equivalent to compliance with the U.S. requirements. Its failure to provide an explanation is even more profound in light of the fact that the agency has engaged in decades of fact-finding on the vision standards for commercial drivers. For example, in 1992, the agency issued a notice that it was going to re-examine its vision standards in light of instructions from Congress to review those standards because Congress had just passed the ADA. And one of the specific questions that the agency asked in the notice it issued was, what's the appropriate level of color perception for a commercial driver? But after significant notice or comment and consideration, the agency concluded it was not going to change its standards. And since 1971, that has been the standard. So in light of that, it makes no sense for the agency here not to have considered how accepting a less stringent vision standard would have affected safety or will affect safety on this nation's roads. And very briefly, I want to touch on the NEPA question here, or one of the threshold questions. Clearly, when an agency performs its duties under NEPA, it is supposed to do so before it takes final agency action. It's unreasonable under Realty Income Trust, one of this court's decisions, for an agency to wait until after final approval, as it did here, of the final action before it releases a draft environmental review document. For that reason alone, the agency's environmental assessment and the pilot program should be set aside. I see my time is up, so if there are no further questions, I will reserve time for rebuttal.
All right, thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Michael Abadi on behalf of the United States. The pilot program at issue in this case is the final step to resolving a nearly 30-year-old dispute between Mexico and the United States, and is necessary in order to make good on promises the United States undertook 20 years ago as part of the North American Free Trade Agreement, and in order to eliminate the threat of billions of dollars of retaliatory tariffs assessed against U.S. goods going to Mexico. When designing this program, the Secretary very carefully based it upon the existing rules and regulations that govern the operation of Mexico-domiciled carriers in the United States. Those rules are set forth in Section Part 365 of Title 49 of the Code of Federal Regulations, and were largely dictated by Congress in Section 350 of the 2002 Appropriations Act that's discussed in the briefs. The Secretary has promulgated those rules, which are much stricter, I will note, than the rules that govern commercial zone carriers, and under Part 368. And those rules themselves have proven to allow safe and effective operations within the commercial zones by Mexico.
What about the introduction into interstate commerce and the import provision? Those strike me as difficult issues. So on interstate commerce, they rely on Brinegar.
I would love to address Brinegar. If I may make a very basic
brief, did so.
Well, no, it wasn't. It was not addressed in their opening brief, Your Honor. It was raised only in their reply brief. But let me make a very basic point before getting to Brinegar. To come back to your other question, this program does comply with the safety standards. As part of the 365 application process for the OP1 application, every carrier must certify that each vehicle to be used in the program complies or has been retrofitted to comply with applicable federal motor vehicle safety standards that were in effect at the time of the vehicle's manufacture. And the PASA process, the pre-authorization safety audit, checks that. So FMCSA will check that. Having said that, they make an argument that notwithstanding that application process, there is a technical violation here because these vehicles do not bear a sticker showing that at the time they were manufactured, they met those requirements. We do not think that the sticker certification requirement applies here under the statute. They are not imported because that definition is a term of art in customs parlance, which means, you know, documents have been filled out to enter or import the documents or the goods into the United States.
How is it not an import if there's a commercial transaction to bring the truck into the United States? So it's not just someone driving in. It's not just an entry in the sense of someone driving in. You're paying for someone to come in. If you're in San Antonio and you start a taxi service and you have Mexican drivers come in and do the taxi service, is that an import of their cars or not?
No, the cars are not imported, Your Honor. No, if there were goods on the truck, they're being imported. But that term, as it's always been construed in customs parlance and here, is it's not...
Not always, because from 2002 to 2005, your client construed it the opposite way.
No, to back up, trucks from Canada and Mexico have driven into the United States for decades. without bearing U.S. federal motor vehicle safety standards. You are correct that in 2002, there was a proposal to adopt a very informal letter that had been issued many years before, but never really implemented, as the interpretation of the term import.
And yeah, it goes into some detail explaining.
It does. You're absolutely right, Your Honor. But in 2005, after consideration of comments and after consideration of the international effect that would have, both FMCSA and NHTSA determined not to take that approach. And they issued joint Federal Register notices in 2005 saying, we do not construe the term import in this way, and there is no requirement that the car bear a sticker. That's been the way it's operated in real-world terms for a very long time. And as you pointed out, Your Honor, this is not just commercial vehicles. It is any motor vehicle. 30112 speaks to any motor vehicle. So that would mean a Canadian citizen, a Mexican citizen, a U.S. citizen in either of those locations.
I guess the line I would see is that it's the car, the truck, the vehicle being brought in connection with a commercial transaction.
But that's not the argument here. The argument is that a car driven across the border is being imported, full stop, not because it is participating in a commercial activity. The truck doesn't stay here.
Now, why is my interpretation wrong?
Well, because, Your Honor, the truck does not stay here. Import, as used in this context, and we cited some customs cases and some notices from DHS's Customs Bureau, import to enter, as it used to be used in the statute, means to fill out documents and paperwork to bring goods into the country for resale. The trucks are merely the mechanism that's delivering it. They're no more imported into the country than an airplane is that takes off and lands and returns. They're a vehicle for delivering. The goods themselves absolutely are imported.
So suppose I don't know, order a car that's built somewhere else and it's delivered here.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an import of the car?
If it's to stay here, yes, it would have to be, that vehicle would have to be imported and it would have to comply with various restrictions. But that's different than merely driving across the border.
I think the line you're drawing on my hypothetical is the difference between temporary
sure.
and permanent.
Yes, and I think that's reflected. And there are other, if you look at the portions of the statutes, Your Honor, that used the term enter, where we were parsing what import meant. One of them, for example, speaks of a military or diplomatic officer from another country who is bringing the car in while they're stationed in the United States for some temporary period of time. You know, they enter and then they leave. That's the sort of circumstance
how
in which the car would be imported.
Certainly. The truck's here for 30 days.
That's not, as I understand it, how any of these trucks are working or the operations. I'm not here to give you an absolute, you know, minimum bottom line, and you don't need to decide that for this. But what we have here are operations going into and out of the country that are no different than passenger cars or other vehicles. To briefly address Briniger.
Do you want to hit Briniger?
Yes, and to briefly address Briniger. Briniger was a very different case about transportation entirely within the boundaries of the U.S. and the United States. And the question was, does a statutory definition that talks about within a state in place to another state in place, does that encompass people who are arguably driving only within the state? That's very different than this question, which is, does a trip that originates outside the United States and ends in the United States constitute introduction into interstate commerce? And we would submit that their interpretation of that case would have absurd results, because it would mean that no passenger car from Canada or Mexico could enter the United States, because they don't bear those stickers unless for some reason they were manufactured in the U.S. and, you know, then it wound up in Canada or Mexico. That would be a radical expansion of the impact of Briniger, and we think that just doesn't make sense here. You know, if Congress really intended that, there would presumably be some discussion that it was not just, you know, that it was intending that kind of radical expansion of this certification requirement. And I want to come back to the basic point is really.
Briniger was dealing with buses.
That's correct, tires. And in fact, it was not even this certification statute, Your Honor. It was a separate provision of that act, Title II, which concerned regrooved tires. So it was not even the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standard certification. The question turned on, you know, is that tire introduced into interstate commerce? And if nothing else, the intrastate versus international distinction should give this court pause before expanding the ruling into this context, where it would have grave consequences. I mean, we're talking about between, you know, Canada, Mexico, and the United States, something on the order of 10, 11, 12 million border crossings each year, carrying hundreds of billions of dollars of goods. And there are a number of arguments like this one that, if adopted, would effectively halt that. And this court, we submit, should look carefully at those statutory arguments before finding that that sort of consequence is compelled.
That consequence, if we say any entrance, you mean?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And there are many of other examples. And if I can turn to some of their other merits ones, the vision standards, once again.
Well, let me just stick on import here for a minute. On the, what about the idea that the overall purpose of this is road safety, and so Congress would not have wanted, hypothetically, unsafe Mexican trucks driving on U.S. highways?
Well, we think the program here clearly would meet that statutory purpose in that it verifies.
Statutory theory would allow unsafe Mexican trucks on U.S. highways.
Your Honor, it's not. We're not arguing that the Vehicle Safety Act was not intended to further safety. Far from it. Our point is that you look at the words of the statute and the definitions of that, and you have to interpret those as given.
It's plausible that Congress, writing this statute, thought actually it doesn't apply to foreign trucks.
Yes, because, and we've cited in our brief other transportation statutes that define interstate commerce to include transportation and trips that begin outside the United States and end in the United States. It did not do that in this statute.
But on import.
Again, yes, we think that that's the best reading of the statute. It's certainly a fair reading that's entitled to deference. And as we pointed out, the 2005 notices make clear what the department's position is, and the department adheres to that position. If I can briefly address the point about vision standards, what's missing from this discussion is that the baseline under existing U.S. law, Part 391.41 of the CFR, Title 49, says if you're a driver from Canada or Mexico who has a license from your respective country, you need not possess a medical certificate in the United States. The reason for that is that we have entered into two separate binding international agreements honoring the medical exams conducted by Canada and Mexico, which, unlike in the United States, are part of the licensing requirement. The U.S. has indicated that it is moving towards the model applied by Canada and Mexico, where you need to be medically certified to get a license. But at current, in the United States, they're separate processes. So there is no requirement at all that a Canadian or a Mexican driver obtain a medical certificate. And at the threshold, that defeats the vision standard claim. But nonetheless, the Secretary looked at the various standards in the Federal Register notices and concluded that overall, the vision standard in Mexico is higher than in the United States. It contains tests for very serious eye problems that we don't look for, like glaucoma, tests to intraocular pressure. And overall, the medical standards as a whole in Mexico are more rigorous than in the United States because they're the same for airline pilots, for locomotive operators, for merchant mariners. They're conducted only by the government, by certified trained physicians. You know, the U.S. recently went through a process to update the medical registry standard to get us closer to where Mexico has been for a long time. But it is the longstanding position of the United States that those are at least equivalent. And as a result, the Code of Federal Regulations says no medical certificate is required. And then briefly, there was some discussion of NEPA. And I want to point out just a couple of basic points on that argument as well. There is no dispute with the finding of no significant impact for the alternatives considered by the agency. Petitioners have made a number of arguments about things that should have been considered instead, and I will address those briefly, but they don't dispute the basic point that we studied the details of this program, that we found no significant impact. So what they're asking for here is a remand to conduct an even later NEPA analysis about other alternatives that the agency could have considered, in their view, that would have had an equally or maybe even less significant impact. But that's not within NEPA's rule of reason, particularly where the alternatives they've asked this court to consider are outside the statutory authority of the agency. The Supreme Court said in Public Citizen that FMCSA has no authority to regulate emissions. And this court said in the Citizens Against Burlington case, written by then Judge Thomas, that the goals of an agency program delimit what reasonable alternatives must be considered. Here, the goal is to test the ability of Mexico domicile carriers to operate under the rules that govern operations in the United States. FMCSA does not and cannot require certain engineers for emissions as a unilateral rule. In fact, those don't apply to operators at all. Those are regulations on people who produce engines. So the idea that they should have included in the NEPA analysis some additional study of other engine years that wouldn't apply at the conclusion of the program simply doesn't fit the rule of reason. And if I may, finally, I would like to address the standing arguments.
So I'm clear on that. The agency chose a particular year. It could not have chosen a later year?
Not unilaterally, no. No, Mexico agreed to that as part of the negotiation process. But for the pilot program, and more importantly, for NEPA purposes, at the conclusion of the pilot program, there's no requirement regarding emission year, period. U.S. operators similarly can drive whatever truck they happen to, you know, own and operate. They don't have an ongoing duty to retrofit their trucks every time EPA upgrades engine standards. That applies to manufacturers of new vehicles, not to operators of existing vehicles. And finally, on the timing point, I'm sorry, on NEPA, if we're right about, well, first of all, they're wrong to say that we didn't have discretion to change the program as relevant to the NEPA analysis after we entered in the MOU. That misinterprets the MOU. The MOU was a broad outline of the program. It did not specify the details of the inspection protocols that would be applied. That is what was studied in the NEPA analysis. The agency retained discretion to change that up until the time that the first inspection was conducted, and even on an ongoing basis, should problems be determined. Therefore, we retained the discretion to change things if necessary. But even if that were a timing violation, it would be a harmless error at most. If we're right about the scope of the analysis being correct, there would be no point in remanding for another determination of a finding of no significant impact where they don't challenge that the alternatives studied here, in fact, were produced no significant impact. And briefly on standing, we dispute that Pena is relevant or controls here for a couple of reasons. On the injury claim, the increased risk of harm claims, this court's subsequent cases in Mountain States and in Public Citizen versus NHTSA make clear that there has to be a very strict understanding of what constitutes the necessary showing to satisfy Article 3. In both of those cases, the plaintiffs were required to come forward not just with declarations that like these declarations do, make general statements like, I believe Mexican drivers are less safe, I believe I will be harmed. They had statistical analyses by experts showing the percentage increase in the risk of harm. And in NHTSA, that wasn't enough.
Here, they have drivers, I can't remember which one, who says he's been driving for years and he avoids Mexican trucks because they're always involved in these accidents and congestion areas.
Right. They say they believe these drivers are less safe, which, you know, is contrary to
this.
This
is personal experience.
Well, again, Your Honor, that was nowhere near sufficient in this court's under this court's cases in both NHTSA and in Mountain States. There's got to be some attempt.
Any distinction between you and me driving intermittently on the road and somebody whose full-time job is 6 days?
I didn't say that. In this court,
I asked you a question.
No, there may well be some difference, but that's still not enough to get you there.
Why not?
Because we have to look at the program here and the volume of traffic involved, and they have to show something more than speculation. That was the entire point.
How would they meet that?
Well, first of all, they could try to do like the plaintiffs in the NHTSA case, in the Public Citizen v. NHTSA case did. They could try to quantify, okay, what are the number of trips that are going to result from this program that wouldn't have before?
You know how statisticians and probability analyses can be challenged.
But that's exactly the point, Your Honor.
That's my point. Do they have to come in with an injured body?
No, they don't, but they have to come in with something. Had they tried
This man says, I've been driving out here 6 days a week. I avoid these trucks because they're involved in these accidents. This is personal, on the scene.
That's not sufficient in our view. Had they have come forward and tried to quantify the likelihood that this person might encounter a pilot program driver as opposed to a commercial zone or some other driver, we would have had the opportunity to look at their analysis and contest it, like happened in the remand in the two Public Citizen cases. They can't avoid the duty of establishing the imminence of injury under Article 3 simply by making vague, conclusory statements about the likelihood that they might encounter someone. They have to prove it. In Mountain States, this court found standing because the plaintiffs there had statistically demonstrated it was more than three times more likely that they were that there would be this serious wildfire event, using the agency's own calculations about the amount of trees in the area.
So you must submit statistical evidence.
That's one way to do it. I'm not trying to to specify every way they could go about it.
But I'm trying to understand what the government's position is.
Sure. If they had valid statistical evidence, that may well do it. We would reserve the right to challenge it.
May do it. Okay, that's my point.
Now, if they had valid statistical proof.
Don't interrupt.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Valid statistical evidence, evidence of an accident, you say that would not be enough?
Oh, I never said an accident wouldn't be.
I'm asking a question. Yeah. Would an accident be sufficient?
Well, it's difficult for future harm. I'd have to look at the declaration. It's hard to imagine exactly what it would say. But their challenge has to be based on future imminent harm. This is not a tort suit for past harm from an accident. It's a prediction about the likelihood of injury from the program. So it may well be, Your Honor. I'm not trying to avoid your question, but we'd have to see what the overall standing showing was. In terms of the competitive standing, the difference between this case and Pena is that it is not the agency's decision to unilaterally open the border to this program. The political branches have determined that the president should relax the moratorium, or the president determined to lift the moratorium, and Congress directed a program be conducted. The agency had no discretion here or was not at liberty to unilaterally decide not to allow the competition about which they complain. And since their competitive standing claims don't go
particular. Their whole theory is that the statute doesn't allow it. I mean, part of their theory.
As competition generally, their competitor standing claims are very, these trucks are in the United States.
Their argument is the agency is violating the statute and allowing Mexican trucks in, which is taking business from us, U.S. truckers. That seems to me to be a kind of classic, obvious case of competitor standing. Why is that wrong?
Because it is Congress that directed in Section 6901 I see my time is up if I can respond to this. Congress directed a pilot program be conducted prior to opening the border, and the president had ordered the moratorium lifted, which otherwise required FMCSA to start granting
the
operating authority.
That's a legal argument on the merits, mm-hmm. But in terms, they're arguing that's wrong. It's illegal, and they're harmed. The standing issue, all we look to is the harm, and they're harmed because the Mexican trucks are taking business from the U.S. truckers.
No, and to the extent that they're facing competition at all, those were decisions of the political branches, and that's simply our point. They're outside of the zone of interest, or they're antithetical to the purpose of Section 6901 in making this claim, because the President and Congress have directed that this program exists and that they face the very competition that they are now complaining about. So our point is simply, to the extent they're complaining about competition, it's not FMCSA's fault. It's Congress's and the President's, because they have directed that this program be conducted, and therefore it's...
I'm probably going to be repeating myself. I just don't see that. The agency's violating the statute in their view. If the agency were complying with the statute, there would not be Mexican trucks on the road, and the U.S. truckers would have the business.
Well, I guess
that's just black-letter competitor standing.
Sure, Your Honor, I guess I would dispute exactly what their complaint is in the way you've presented it. I don't think that the complaint is simply because of the terms and conditions of the program that they're facing competition. I think their complaint is that there is a program at all, that the agency is going forward.
And their complaint is that if the agency were complying with the law, namely the statutes, there wouldn't be such a program.
I guess I've not understood that, because Section 6901...
The import argument and the introduction into commerce argument, and we'll get to the next case, but other arguments...
Right. But Congress directed there be such a program, so it's hard for me to understand how the agency would not be conducting this program. And I guess that's why we think that this runs contrary to congressional intent, because Section 6901 says conduct this program. And in fact, the registration statute, 13902, says you shall register every motor carrier that's fit and able. So we do think that there is a difference in the competitor standing argument here. And finally, on the NEPA standing, there still must be an Article III injury. It is a procedural statute, but your procedural claim cannot be untethered to some actual harm, and we think it's the harm from the NEPA claims is simply another increased risk of harm claim, that there's an increased risk I'll be subjected to these emissions or these environmental harms, and until they can show that there's an actual likelihood that they will encounter this, we don't think that the fact that it's a NEPA claim gets them.
Well, they offered a declaration that a man who is a driver on these very same roads has asthma problems.
Yes, but I...
Mexican trucks do not use the same type of fuel that American trucks use.
That is correct, Your Honor, but we, again, we don't, as we pointed out in our brief, we don't think that's sufficient for at least two reasons. They don't disaggregate the harm of emissions from these Mexican trucks, which they don't say they're likely to encounter, but they don't disaggregate that from what's also in that same declaration, that I live in a very polluted area of Southern California that harms me. I drive a truck all day long, and I'm exposed to my own diesel exhaust, and I'm very concerned about that. They talk about all these general environmental factors and then tack on, and I'm also sort of concerned that, you know, that there might be a Mexican truck in the area and that it might add to that. But
so a petitioner in a NEPA claim has to get an expert to disaggregate the various contributions
or
to
at a,
pollution
at a minimum.
Or a petitioner can say that the additional harm caused by the Mexican trucks is, quote, the straw that's breaking the back, camel's back. And
no, that's not precisely our argument. At a minimum, they have to show there's some sort of likelihood they're going to encounter pilot program drivers in circumstances they otherwise wouldn't have. And
so
that's a threshold showing they haven't made.
Why do you say that? The driver says he's on this road all the time. These are the roads the Mexican trucks are coming on. They don't use the same kind of fuel. Their fuel is going to cause more pollution. It's going to aggravate his asthma.
Right. And
what more need be said?
Well, they certainly don't argue that they've ever run into these drivers before. As you pointed out, the declaration, well, I'll leave the competitor point aside, but they can't just say, there's going to be trucks on the road, I'm on the road too, good enough. There's got to be some plausible likelihood, and we don't think they've shown it.
Fuel, my asthma condition, in any event. All right, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
How much time does Ms. Chisholm have? Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. A few brief points in response. First, with respect to the safety certification statute, the statute requires certification. Congress thought that certification was something that needed to be required. Whether we minimize it by calling it a label or a decal, Congress said you need to do this. It did not say that drivers, that Mexican drivers and Mexican carriers can self-certify, which is the system that the agency has set up here. So that does not comply with the statute. Briefly on the interstate commerce question, I don't think the government can distinguish at all the Brinegar case here. It's the exact same definition. The fact that the intrastate buses were traveling on interstate highways was sufficient to allow Judge Robinson there to say that we must be concerned with the safety, that Congress clearly intended that when you entered onto a public highway, you needed to comply with the law at issue there, which was requiring a certain kind of tire. It's the same here. When Congress said, in order to enter into interstate commerce, you need to comply with this certification requirement, it meant what it said. And it's not this court's job to be suggesting as a policy matter that there might be other ways of ensuring the same level of safety. Congress said what it meant, which was you have to have these labels. On the question of the comparability of the driver's licenses, the agency has repeatedly referred to the international agreement and the CFR section that recognizes the Mexican driver's license as a driver's license that can be used in the United States. They miss, however, the point of petitioner's claim. Petitioner's claim is under the pilot project statute or the pilot program statute, which requires that in designing a pilot program, the agency design it in such a way as to achieve an equivalent level of safety. Therefore, the agency must engage in a reasoned analysis of whether accepting Mexican drivers who can't see red, green, and yellow will achieve the same level of safety as if they could comply with the U.S. requirement. Here, they didn't engage in that. The 1992 decision that they refer to does not, there's no assessment of the equivalent level of safety there. There's no reasoned assessment that waiving the requirement of red, yellow, and green vision would not create a safety problem. Nor could they be, given the 20 years of agency action on that particular issue. Turning to the NEPA claim here, Council stated if they're right about the scope, then there's a larger issue. And I think that's important to note here. One of our claims is that the NEPA process here was unduly restricted. The agency said, our hands are tied here. We can't consider anything except for the exact moment when these trucks go over the border and what we do with those trucks. We can't consider their diesel exhaust on the roads in California or in Arizona or in Kentucky or wherever they're going. That is clearly not true. They tied their hands based on the Supreme Court's ruling in Public Citizen, but that ruling was very different. It found that there was no discretion whether to let the trucks in or not. Here, Congress, in the 2007 Act, clearly and unambiguously gave the agency discretion to design a pilot program. It can't walk away from that discretion. In fact, it claims that it continues to have some discretion, such that the fact that the draft EA came out only after the final program was implemented is not a problem. So they can't have it both ways is the first point. But the second point is that clearly in designing the pilot program, there were a whole host of issues they could have considered with respect to the environmental effects of the program that they refused to do so because they artificially confined their review. And then just a final point on standing. The agency really doesn't have an answer to IBT's competitor standing here. Their only answer is to say that the fact that the agency action is going to happen somehow limits our standing to contest that as being in violation of the law. It's really, I think what they're arguing is a prudential standing argument. And of course, for prudential standing, we only need to arguably be within the zone of interest of the Act. Here, in the 2007 Act, Congress was clearly concerned that the pilot program be as safe as compliance with U.S. regulations, and therefore not let in trucks that would unduly compete with U.S. trucks and drivers. So I think there can be no doubt that we fall within the zone of interests. If there are no further questions, I am happy to start.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.